All right, so last week we talked pretty extensively about debt, and if you've missed any of these sessions, I think we're through the first 4 points. So number one is a budget doesn't work without planning. A budget doesn't work without planning. Number two, we talked about the main categories of a healthy budget. And number three, a terrible example of how to run a budget is the U.S. government. And number four, I know I've got it here for the exact wording, debt is a severe hindrance to a healthy budget. So I think I mentioned on Sunday morning, but if you missed any of these and you want to go back and get them, they are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and a couple other of those, the audio from our Wednesday night sessions. And last week we talked pretty extensively about debt, and we're kind of in the meat of the practical aspects and application of these financial principles. So we kind of have less scripture in here than I normally would and would normally want to have for things that I'm teaching. But just kind of keep that in mind that sometimes that's how we learn as we talk about the practical. So we give the scriptures, we explain them in context, and then a lot of what we're doing in the middle of this is talking about wise principles. And these are a different category of teachings than doctrinal teachings would be or salvation issues. And some of these things I said last week, how God leads you to handle these things in your home might be different than mine, and that's okay, but we still want to talk about the scriptures and the principles in a way that hopefully is not like making people feel bad about things you've done financially, but is just stuff to think about and plan for the future that maybe God would help you. So we talked almost all last week about debt and about Proverbs 22:7, the general principle being the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. So I don't think that debt is a sin. As I said, it's a different category than doctrinal teachings, and Proverbs is teaching a proverb at a time, a principle. And the general principle is that whenever there's a relationship where someone has borrowed money and someone has lent the money, if you borrow, then you're in the position of servant. You're in the position of being indebted to whoever lent you the money until such a time as you can pay it back. They have a moral and a legal obligation to get that money back from you. So you're kind of in the underneath of the power dynamic when it comes to money, if you borrow money from someone. And we read from the Old Testament last week how God said to the nation of Israel, I'm going to bless you. And as a sign of them being a blessed nation, he said, you will lend to others, but you won't have to borrow. So it's a sign of God's blessing if we can make our financial plans without borrowing money and going into debt as much as possible. And we put the graphics up on the screen about how much in America we're paying so much interest on our car loans, our credit cards, our student loan debt. And we said the general principles, advice that I would give from the scripture when it comes to debt in your budget would be, in the first place, avoid it whenever possible. In the second place, pay it off whenever possible. And be prepared, if need be, to run like crazy, to work like crazy, and approach your debt like a maniac for a short period of time so that you can pay it off and you can move forward with a debt-free budget as much as possible. And David asked me about housing at the end of the lesson last week, and we'll talk about that here in a minute if we get that far, about how housing is an important part of our budget. And there are some things like buying a house in America that you're probably going to have to take a loan to do. But outside of that, you probably could do most of your goals without borrowing money, or at least with severely limiting the amount of money that you want to borrow and making a plan to get rid of it really quickly. So why do we want to be debt free? It relieves pressure in our budget to take our money and use it for life, to give to the Lord, to pay our bills, to do what we want to do, and not be in a position where we already in the past made a financial decision that we had to borrow money to accomplish. Now we're always looking backward, paying interest and paying back more than we had to borrow. But if we're able to put that out of our life and not borrow money as much as possible, then our money goes to whatever we want to do now. Again, to use it for the Lord, to save for our future, to invest, and not to have our budget get eaten up with paying interest payments on money that we already borrowed that now we have to pay back to somebody else. So here's just one example of maybe a creative way to get out of debt faster. We talked about car loans last week, and let's just say you really wanted to get out of debt. The debt was piling up, and a big chunk of that was you owed $40,000 on a car. And what happens a lot of the time when you buy a car, especially that expensive, is you get upside down on the car, meaning you owe $40,000, but you're only able to sell it for $30,000. And some people say, well, I'm stuck. And a couple of financial advisors, people who give advice, I've heard say what you could do. Say you owe $40,000 on the car and you can sell it for $30,000. You might be able to go to a credit union, borrow $15,000 on a personal loan. Now you sell the truck for $30,000. You take $10,000 from the credit union and pay off the truck. And then you take $5,000 and buy a $5,000 car. So you say, well, what did that accomplish? In that one move, you would have, yes, gone to a much cheaper vehicle and just decide I'm going to drive the cheaper vehicle until I can afford a nicer one. But you would have gone from $40,000 in debt to $15,000 in debt overnight just by flipping the vehicle, taking out another loan, getting rid of the giant car payment, and driving a cheaper car. And it's a lot easier to get out of $15,000 of debt than it is $40,000 of debt. So I don't know if I lost you on that, but that's just one hypothetical of how sometimes we say, well, yeah, I owe a lot on the car, but I can't sell it for what it's worth. But there might actually be creative ways to sell things, to flip things around, and say, Lord, put me on a trajectory of making sacrifice and working hard so that I can get out of debt. And then some people say, well, I don't want to work overtime my whole life. I don't want to drive a cheap car my whole life. Well, maybe you don't have to, but maybe if you work overtime for a short period of time and drive a cheap car, you can get out of debt. Then you go a few months, you save up $3,000. Well, now you do that a couple times. You can sell the cheap car for $5,000, take the $6,000 cash you've saved up, and now you can pay cash for an $11,000 car, and you move up and improve your lifestyle as you're able to do it and actually pay for it without going into debt. So the reason we would pray for the ability to be debt-free as much as possible and to stop borrowing money or stop racking up credit card debt if we've done that in the past is so that we'll have more room to breathe in our budget. We'll have more money to spend, to give, to use for unexpected emergencies. And that's one very important factor to consider, is that debt does not factor in risk or changes to your current equation. So in other words, sometimes we want to buy something and we say, what's the monthly payment? I can afford the monthly payment. So we might borrow the $40,000, $50,000 not thinking about the overarching impact of that decision, because we say, well, it fits in my budget and I can make the payment. But one of the reasons why credit card debt continued to skyrocket throughout the pandemic is a lot of people lost their job or they lost their ability to work overtime. Depending on what your paid leave policy is at work, if you have a physical job and you break your leg, you might get to the end of your paid leave and you'd have to figure out how to float your budget for 3 months until you get your health back. So basically debt is risky because it doesn't factor in unexpected changes that might make it harder for your budget to fit with that debt. So this is just kind of a silly illustration, but a few months ago, we wanted to buy a new couch and we shopped around for a while and we looked and we compared and we went to 3 stores and then she picked the couch she was happy with. And then a week later, she said, well, I don't think I want that couch. And so after all this, we decided, okay, let's buy the couch. And usually what happens with us is we end up making a decision and I wish that we had done it for a little bit cheaper because I'm kind of cheap by nature and I don't really like spending money. And I need people sometimes to tell me, like James did, go ahead and buy the nicer iPad so the church live stream isn't crashing all the time. Because if you have the money, it's not always a bad thing to spend the money and get nice things. Okay? So we bought the couch and what we were planning on was, I mean, we weren't counting on it, but Melissa had a lot of shifts coming up in the month of July. And I said, well, at least her work in those shifts are going to help offset the new couch cost. And then she went to play racquetball with her brother Matthew and she tore her knee up really bad. Now, as it happened, she's okay with a couple of trips to physical therapy. She got cleared to go back to work, but we thought for a while she was going to have surgery, and it looked like she wasn't going to be able to take any of those extra shifts that she does as a substitute at the hospital to make some money. So that's just one random example, but what we could do is say, well, yeah, I'm having this money that's coming up, or I'm getting this raise. We borrow money And then what if something goes wrong? We may not always be able to pay it back right away like we thought we would. So what we're doing is we eliminate risk when we're able to pay cash. Not meaning necessarily you take the paper bills, but whether you write a check, take the paper bills, or you swipe the debit card, if it's going directly from your account and paying it off and you're not borrowing it with interest, it's always going to be healthier in the long run if you're able to do that. So for example, owning rental properties are a really cool thing, and a lot of people want to get into that, but sometimes people don't factor in that when you have renters, sometimes they don't pay. And then sometimes there might be a global pandemic and the government might say, you're not allowed to evict your renters no matter how long they don't pay for. And then the property owner is sitting here with a bunch of properties and the government has forbidden them from collecting rent or from evicting the renters that aren't paying. So if there's a lot of debt and very tight margins and the person owning all the rental houses is counting on getting paid every single month or else he can't pay his own mortgages, then when something goes bad, it just increases the risk for things not being able to go as well as we would like it to, the more that debt is involved. And I wanted to say this too, is that it's kind of a difficult plan in some ways to say, well, pay cash for everything and save up money and also give. But people do practice this as an overall plan. And when people do, it's difficult. But in the long run, it breeds a lot of success. So, for example, I heard of one church in the South who they had a small church that their pastor had gone to another church. They were without pastors for a while. And the church grew to about 140 people. But I don't think they ever had much more than that. But they were a lot of people who had taken the Financial Peace University classes. They took it at the church, and a lot of people were already practicing out that plan. And what happened was, especially without having a church, a pastor to pay his salary for a little while and the church growing, was the church savings were piling up faster than they were able to figure out what to do with the money. So I think they were giving away at least 10% to missions the whole time, but their budget in savings in a short period of time, even without a pastor there for some of it, ballooned to like $750,000 in the bank just because it was a church of about 150 people that weren't taking out debt, that were trying to follow that financial peace plan where that we put the seven steps up on the screen a few weeks ago, and they believed in tithing, so they were running a budget where they were giving 10% of everything they made to the local church, and the church was doing extremely well. So I agree, it's not the point of the church to pile up money and save it, but they were able to pay $350,000 cash to totally redo their entire property, fix the foundation, get rid of mold on the ceiling, and set the church up for success for the next 20 or 30 years, and then still figure out what are we going to do with the rest of this money to either take care of the church or to give it away. And it just so happened that down the road, the church kind of split off and went to a much lower number of people. I don't know the situation, but might have gone to a lower income. So what they probably were glad that they did is that they didn't go out and remodel the auditorium based off of debt, saying, well, we need exactly this level of giving in order to pay it off. But a group of people who were trying to follow these biblical principles and be generous and the church being wise in the way they handled money, they were able to do a lot of really good things for the Lord. And I just kind of have a personality where spending money in general makes me sick. And I don't think it's because I'm the smartest or whatever. My wife said maybe it's because of parents who grew up in the ministry and watching how their budget was tight a lot of the time, that there's something there in my brain that spending money, even when it makes sense on paper, I have to tell myself it's okay to spend the money. So sometimes I'd like to avoid spending things or getting a big payment or financial endeavor in my life just to avoid the stress and the complications that come from trying to manage that all the time. This kind of off topic a little bit, but has anybody ever heard a commercial on the radio of somebody saying, we'll help you get rid of your timeshare? Has anybody ever heard that? The reason being is that timeshares are infamous for saying, come get a free dinner or a free night's hotel on your vacation if you listen to our presentation. And the basics of the presentation is it's a high pressure sales pitch. and they'll get you to buy a timeshare where like there's a condo unit or a network of them, and they convince you by saying, well, you're going to go on vacation every year, and it's this much cheaper if you buy the timeshare, so you're really stupid if you don't buy it. And it's very high-pressure sales tactics. And what happens is people buy it, and they might not realize they're virtually impossible to get rid of. Sometimes there's dues fees. Well, they'll come in and say, well, we're doing improvements to the condo, and it's in your contract. You don't get a vote on whether or not you have to help pay for it. So your fee is going through the roof, and that's why there's a whole industry of people who try to help you get rid of your timeshare. So that's just one example where we could, in a moment, without taking 30 days to pray about it and research it, get real excited and jump at the timeshare and then think, well, maybe I don't want to go on vacation to Missouri every summer or twice a year for the rest of my life. Maybe I could have just saved for it and gone on vacation when I wanted to. Again, that's just one example of something to be careful for. Okay, so a couple more things on debt. I know we're giving a lot of time to this, but we have a video series that's a mini marriage counseling series that is entitled Ready to Wed. It's a video series with a workbook. Melissa and I took it to kind of vet it out, and it was very good information, even for us being married for a few years. And I think Anna and Andrew went through it, and Jorge and Ashton are going to as well. And there's an episode on there where it talks about finances and how important it is as a married couple to be on the same page about our finances. And we'll get to a whole section on that in a minute. But my main point in bringing that up is there was a lady that they interviewed for the episode whose name is Mary Hunt. I've never looked up any of her teachings, but I think she runs her own website about debt-free living or cheapskate, something where she tries to say, here's how I got on a good track financially after being on a bad one, and has some tools for you to buy or help you. But her story was that she got married, and over several years, the first, I don't know how long, she said she had two little kids by then, so I'd picture at least 4 or 5 years of her marriage, she had credit cards. And she was living her life by using the credit card all the time without really planning out, am I going to be able to pay it off? How much interest is it going to cost? And I think she said a couple of different things in the interview, but I tried to look it up online, and she said something about, against my husband's wishes and without his knowledge, my credit card debt was skyrocketing. And I think she said something in the video series too about her husband being kind of passive about it, being like, well, I want her to be happy and I don't want to confront her too much. So if she has these credit cards, you know, my job might only be able to afford so much, but I love my new bride. I want her to be happy. But she said at one point, all those years down the road with two little kids, her husband had started finding the statements and trying to figure out what actually had been going on and how bad the situation was. And when he confronted her about it, remember, this is decades ago, she had racked up over $100,000 in credit card debt. And what she described in the interview was basically having a panic attack, laying on the carpet on the ground in her bedroom, not being able to breathe, trying to figure out how she had spent so much money on just shopping and on life and on regular things without paying attention. And she said, I purposed in my heart that since I had run up that debt, I was going to get income and I was going to pay back every penny of that $100,000 of credit card debt, which being a long time ago would be even more in today's debt. And she said, it took me 13 years to pay the money back. I can't imagine the interest on that much. What we talked about, the average rate today is 24% interest on a credit card. And if you borrow $10,000 and only paid the minimums, it would take you 20 years to pay it back, and you would have paid an extra $20,000 in interest. So the point that she was trying to make was to tell people who are getting married, talk about, be on the same page financially, and understand that debt, when it gets out of hand, can really become an anchor that can drag down your budget, that can affect your marriage, and that can be very difficult to get out of. It's very easy to get into, but can be very difficult to get out of. And I'm wanting to say a lot more about marriage, but I think under point 7, I'm going to come back to talk about that, which at this rate, maybe next week. We're not rushing through this material, so I'll just move on for now. I'm almost done with the section on debt. So I heard when I was a teenager, a man teaching a class in the church about money and about the dangers of debt. And he put it this way. He said, what if next month, you were hearing preaching, and God came to your heart, and he called you to be a missionary to Africa. How scary that would be, how much training you would have to be. You might have to learn the language. You might have to go to Bible college to learn the scriptures more. He said, but what about from a financial aspect? Would you basically be free to go if God called you to go be a missionary in Africa? Or would you have so much debt and entanglements financially in your life that you would either need half a decade to get free, or you would need the church to pay off your personal debts in order to even send you out as a missionary? That's just one good way to think about it, to show that being debt free really can give us some more financial freedom if we're able to work towards that and, Lord willing, live our life that way. I have a saying that I've kind of got to in my head that helps me with, like I said, the spending a significant amount of money, even if it makes sense on paper. I just feel uncomfortable. I don't like it. And what I like to say, if it's a church expenditure or a home expenditure that I was nervous about, I've talked to other people about, we decide to do it, I like to tell myself, at least we paid cash. Meaning, even if this is a purchase that maybe was a little bit too rich for where we're at or for a trajectory to always be able to do stuff like this, at least if we paid for it with money we already have, then if our income goes down, if our giving goes down, if we preach a message and the church splits because of the message we preached, at least what we bought is already in the past and it's done with. And going forward, we can adjust and not buy it next time if that's what we need to do. So paying cash for things really can lead you to peace and peace of mind, which is a lot of what we're talking about with finances. It's honoring God, and it's also just wanting to live in a way where we're not always stressed out because of money. So a question that some people will ask is, should you have a credit card at all? If you do have credit cards and you're trying to pay them off, should you just cut them up and get rid of them? And I remember kind of going along this topic last year. Sarissa did some ballet classes and I was off a day in December. So I got to take her to her class and I heard one of the moms talking to the other moms. And this is Allen, Texas, where we live kind of on the poor side of Allen, as it were. There's a lot of wealthy people there. And the one lady was talking to the other mom and she said, yeah, we just usually do whatever and then we pay the credit cards off later. We don't really like budget or any of that. We just kind of do what we want. And then later when we have money, we pay off the credit cards. And I think she was saying something like, but right now we're finding it more difficult to just pay off the credit card a month or two later because everything's getting more expensive. Okay, so the guy named Dave Ramsey, who teaches the Financial Peace University, he has a philosophy that nobody should ever have a credit card, just have a debit card, cut up your credit card, and throw it away. Other people say you should have a credit card and use it for basic expenditures like getting gas or buying groceries, but make sure you pay it off every single month, and that will give you a good credit score if you do go to buy a house or rent an apartment or something like that. Dave Ramsey says there's always a way around that, and he endorses a mortgage company that will manually underwrite your loan and will give you a loan even if you have never had a credit score or never swiped it. I think his reasoning being some people have a propensity to lose track of it, to get way in debt, and it's bad for them, so you might be risking it if you have a credit card. Nobody should ever do it. That lady, Mary Hunt, said she teaches something like take your credit cards and put them in a drawer while you're paying them off. Don't cut them up or get rid of them. Have one you keep active for a credit score. I did hear somebody say if you want to deactivate a credit card and you're like, I'm never going to spend on this one again, maybe instead of cutting it up, tell the bank to send you a new one. Whether you tell them you lost it or you're worried about security, they send you one with a different number. That way, in case there's a place you forgot that you had it linked to or somebody had that as your payment information, they can't just come ding that card and it have expenditures you don't know about. What I've done since I was 17 is I got a credit card. I use it for my everyday expenses. When I went to buy a house, I had a pretty good credit score. And my only other advice on that is if that's what you want to do, put it on auto pay, because that was when I had to pay interest, was when I forgot, when I moved out on my own, I hadn't been used to paying bills, and I had to pay, like, I saw whatever the interest fee was, it made me really mad, so I tried to set up the auto pay from there on out, where it always just pays it off every month, and then you can have your rewards, build your credit score, whatever. But you, basically, we're saying you try to live your life where you don't have that in your rotation of, oh, well, just swipe it all the time, and then we'll see when we pay it back. That can get you into a difficult place in your budget. The other thing you can do is determine to be disciplined and endure sacrifices for a short period of time so that you can get ahead. And I heard somebody say this recently, I thought was really good. They applied it to giving. His point was, whatever you think about the tithe, if God's commanded it or you don't really have to or whatever, some people like to argue out all that. And we might talk about it a little bit. But his point was, he said, if tomorrow, he said, I always tell somebody who has a struggle with giving, I tell them if tomorrow you unexpectedly had your income slashed by 10%, would you starve to death? And when they think about it, they usually say no. I could find a way to survive if tomorrow my job said, we're sorry, we're going to have to lay you off, but in order to avoid layoffs, what we'll have to do is cut your pay by 10%. So apply that however you want to. If you want to say 5%, 3%, if you're not giving anything to the Lord, there probably is a way that you can look at your budget and say, let me adjust to consistently, generously, proportionally give to the Lord like God's people did all throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. And churches get out of hand when they harp too much on giving in a legalistic way, where they're like, they're going to throw you out of church, or they go to little old ladies and guilt them because they haven't been giving or something like that. But we also could get too far in the other spectrum if we don't teach the scriptures about giving that are clearly throughout the Bible. Okay. But then take that same idea and say, well, if my budget was cut by 10% tomorrow, would I starve to death? And say, well, what if I cut my living by 10% and I used it to pay off debt? How quickly could I get rid of the little debts that are cluttering up my budget and give me more freedom going forward? Now, what that takes is a lot of discipline. And I still have a struggle with the whole idea of the zero-based budget, where every penny is assigned to a category and your overages are assigned to your savings so that at the end of every month, you've assigned every penny of income. I like to know the margins are healthy. I like to watch what's happening. But it takes a lot of discipline to make and practice to make a budget on paper that's tight, and then to learn how to stick to the budget and learn how to say, well, that category of the budget was unrealistic, so I need to allow more money for food, where that's kind of a classic husband and wife thing, where the husband will say, well, we need to save money and you're spending too much on groceries. And, you know, the wife is like, well, look, we're not buying that much. This is what it costs. Well, if I went to the store, I could buy it for cheaper than that. And she's like, okay, well, then go to the store and prove it. And then you go, okay, most people underestimate how much it actually costs to buy groceries, especially in today's climate. My whole point being, but if you practice month after month and get disciplined, you could probably live off of 90%, 85% of what you are now and take the extra money to get out of debt. And then when you're out of debt, well, you just freed up that 10% of your budget, plus going forward, hopefully more, because you're not using that money to pay back debt to somebody else. Another principle to make sure we clarify everything is that there's a principle that in a time of crisis, you defend the four walls of your house. So in other words, you don't have much in savings. You're trying to aggressively pay off all of this credit card debt and clean these different things up. And then, like last week's example, I said, say you have a hole in the roof. Well, what we might do is panic and say there's a hole in the roof. So the first guy who shows up at our door quotes us $12,000 for a total new roof, and we sign the paperwork because we're stressed out. Well, maybe what we do if we don't have the money, I said last week, is you watch a whole bunch of Home Depot videos, you spend a whole day doing that, you go, you get a bucket of tar, you plug the hole in your roof, and then you start saving money. And you get three or four or five quotes so that you make sure you're not buying a roof you didn't actually need. Well, when you have a crisis like that, or a medical emergency, or something that really has to be fixed, like a car, when you lose income, you lose a job, the four walls principle is basically, I'm paying for electricity, my house payment, or my rent, I'm buying food so that we don't starve. And then I'm stopping my aggressively paying down the rest of the debt till I make sure I get through this and I'm in a healthier position to take care of the emergency. and then go back to paying down the other debts. Does that make sense? So you might be on an aggressive plan of I want to be out of debt, but you have an emergency. So then you take 3 months to only pay your minimums and take every penny to pay cash for whatever your emergency was. So you didn't go further into debt. And then you can get back to attacking the rest of it. Okay, that was a lot about debt. Let's see if we get much further than point number five, which is an interesting one. Number five, the Bible says that co-signing is unwise. Okay, and that's just a fact of the scriptures that the Bible pretty flat out says that co-signing is unwise. Now, I was kind of surprised when I was putting this together that the verses about debt, you owing somebody else money, and how that puts you in the position of being a servant to the lender, and it's not really wise, and it's not a sign of blessing. There's actually very few of those verses compared to how many verses there are in Proverbs about the word surety. The word surety means taking on a debt, but it basically literally means guaranteeing the debt of another person. And it might have been because of the culture and the way that they lived back then, and it was harder for you to go get a loan, but you could get your friend to say, sign your house that if I don't pay back my debt, then they can take your house as a surety for the loan. Okay, so surety is guaranteeing the debt of another person and saying, I'll assume responsibility for their debt if they can't pay it back, which is what co-signing is. So let's look at a few scriptures here. Proverbs chapter 6. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend. Again, remember the word surety is guaranteeing the debt of another person. If thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, meaning shaking hands to make a deal, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth. Thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself when thou art come into the hand of thy friend. Humble thyself and make sure thy friend. The idea being here, I think, go try to get out of that situation. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Okay, so a bird being delivered from the hand of the fowler would be the person who's coming to capture the bird, and the bird flees as fast as he can to get away from getting caught in a trap. The word roe, which again, I don't pretend to know anything about the Hebrew language, but it's very interesting and even more nuanced than the Greek of the New Testament. The Bible was originally written in Hebrew in the Old Testament, and the word there for roe can mean a deer or a buck, but a strong concordance also says it can be used for a gazelle. So a gazelle, a deer, whatever you want to say, the idea is the hunter is coming to kill it. It senses the danger and it turns around and it runs as fast as it can, because running and staying out of the situation is the only way to make sure that he's safe and that he lives. So the idea is debt, but specifically it's taking responsibility for the debt of somebody else. And the Bible here in Proverbs says to run from that so that you may be delivered. A couple more. Proverbs 11:15. He that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it. The word there for smart for it simply means he's going to suffer for it. If you're surety for a stranger, for somebody you don't really know or that's foreign to you, that's extremely dangerous, and most likely you'll end up suffering for that. And he that hateth suretyship is sure. And I'm pretty sure from what I read about the end of that verse, it's saying if you look away from the idea of guaranteeing somebody else's debt, you will be secure and sure when you avoid that, because you're avoiding a risky situation. Three more verses here. Proverbs 17:18. A man void of understanding striketh hands and becometh surety in the presence of his friend. Proverbs 22, verse 26. Be not thou one of them that strike hands, or of them that are sureties for debts. If thou hast nothing to pay, why should he take away thy bed from under thee? So this is pretty simple in explaining what this verse is saying. It's saying be very careful to assume responsibility for somebody else's debt. And then he goes, because if you don't have enough money that even if you threw it away, it doesn't matter. If you're guaranteeing somebody else's debt that you can't pay back, then someone's going to come to your house and take your bed out from under you and say, no, you signed the paperwork that your property is the guarantee of this loan. And they could come take away what you have because somebody else didn't pay back their debt. So I remember being at work one day and one of my coworkers who's kind of outspoken was talking, and he's from the Northeast, like my dad came from, and some of those people, they're just kind of gruff in the way that they talk sometimes. And he was saying, my sister called me and said, my nephew, whatever his name, something like Jeffy needs a new truck. And she said, if you would just please come sign the loan, then Jeffy could get a new truck. And my coworker said, you know what? Maybe Jeffy doesn't need a new truck. Maybe Jeffy needs an old truck that Jeffy can pay for. I'm not signing his loan because they're going to come take the money from me if he doesn't pay it back. And sadly, there have been many family relationships that have been severely hurt whenever money becomes the main dynamic. The Dave Ramsey guy says Thanksgiving dinner tastes different when you're in debt to your mother-in-law and she can look at you all the time and say, well, it was a nice vacation you took last year, wasn't it? Well, I still didn't get paid back for what I loaned you 3 years ago. And it's changing that family dynamic and risking that when you throw money into the situation. So again, whatever you've done, I'm just trying to give you biblical principles to watch out for and to keep in mind that I've heard a lot of calls to the finance advice shows too, where someone calls in and basically what happened is when they went to go to college, there was a parent plus loan involved. A parent plus loan means that the student who went to borrow money, they wouldn't get approved for it. So again, which student loans are easier to get approved for than any other loan, which is partially why there's so many people having a hard time paying them back. So when the parent goes in and signs the parent plus loan, who is legally required to pay the debt back? The parent is. So what happens is now it's 7 or 8 years later, and these people call the financial advice show, and they say, I didn't really know what was going on. My parents just said, we're going to help you go to college, and they sign the paperwork. But now my parents see that I'm graduated from college and I'm making good money. And they're like, well, yeah, we always thought you were going to pay it back once you got a job. And they're looking at their budget and they're saying, I don't know that I can really afford that. And how long is it going to take to pay it back? So in that type of situation, there may need to be prayer about maybe if you are making a lot of money, you could pay it back since you got to go to school. But legally required, the parent is on the hook for every single penny of that. And the point being that some people entered into that arrangement without even talking about who was going to pay it back. And now there's all these hurt feelings down the road and people arguing about it because the money's involved. And one side may have been like, oh yeah, it doesn't matter. I'll just pay it if they can't. And then they get stressed financially. And then they see the other person doing better. And it gets very difficult for them to just say, okay, I'll pay it back. But then the other person who went to school is like, well, you never told me it was my responsibility to pay it back, and I'm not legally obligated to do so. So that's just one example. So I'm not saying it's always wrong for you to help your kids or whatever the situation may be, but let me make a couple of bullet points here about this. If you would listen to these statements I wrote out. Only co-sign for somebody else's loan if you actually plan to pay 100% of it back without bad feelings. It's your loan legally. So in other words, you may say, well, I'm going to help family or I'm going to help somebody borrow this money. I'm going to co-sign. And they told me they'll pay it back. I don't care what they told you. If you're not prepared to pay all of it yourself without any bad feelings, then don't co-sign for the loan. Co-signing is one person wanted to borrow money and the bank said, you look like a bad risk. We don't think you'll be able to pay it back. Get somebody to guarantee it. Then somebody who looks better to the bank comes in and signs the loan next to their name. And all that the bank did was they said, okay, we'll give the money to them, but it's actually your loan. And you are 100% on the hook if you don't pay it back. The bank wouldn't approve the other borrower. So obviously it's a risky situation to guarantee their debts. I haven't been in a lot of desperate situations, so I don't know if I could hold to this 100%, but I honestly do feel the conviction in my heart personally for my home is that because of all the biblical warnings against it and the possibility to ruin the relationships, I would decline somebody co-signing for anything I was borrowing. I would decline that and feel a lot better that if I can handle it, fine. If I can't handle it, I don't want to get somebody else involved, and that is my personal conviction on that. Okay, let's cover number 6, and then we'll probably stop there for the night. We're at 7:49 here already. Okay, so number 6 in our outline, housing is an integral part of your budget. And I know I'm moving fast and covering a lot of territory, so if you have a question as we go along, just jot it down, and we'll give a time slot every week for a question or for sharing a story or whatever we're talking about. And if you're too shy to ask in front of everybody, that's okay. But just jot it down, and if you want to go back to anything we talked about throughout the lesson, we can see, you know, kick that around and try to answer that question. Okay, so housing is an integral part of your budget, and I'll just put this one verse up there. Every purpose is established by counsel, and with good advice, make war. Proverbs 20:18. Again, nothing really to do with housing, but a general principle that applies to anything where we're planning for the future. You take good counsel, you get good advice, and you make your war strategy, your plan for the future. That's what the verse is indicating, and housing is a good thing to apply this verse to, because housing is going to be a part of our budget no matter what, unless you're going to try to hike and live out in the woods, which probably isn't going to be much fun, okay? So one of the things that I think people do when they make a mistake with housing is there's a term that's called house poor. And I think we know what that means. It means you buy too much house for your budget, and so much of your budget is going to your living situation that you're stressed in every other area of your budget. So you have a nice house, but your house poor. Now, I believe basically in America today, sound advice is that buying a house is actually a good investment if we do it wisely, okay? So again, I don't endorse everything he says. I know I keep referencing him, but it's just because that's the financial advisor that I've heard to teach the most, that I think gives a very basic sort of like what your grandparents would tell you, who may not have had the nicest of things, but they always had some money in their bank account. They owned the stuff that they used, all of that. It's kind of a common sense meat and potatoes plan. But he has a set of rules for buying a house that he's always recommended. And he says, if you want to buy a house, the best way to do it is to put a 20% down payment, take out a 15-year term instead of a 30-year term, and make sure that at the end of the day, your mortgage is not more than 25% of your take-home budget. So again, I haven't run all the numbers, and we'll talk about the fact that it's getting crazy in America right now. But his advice is that if your after-tax money, you can divide that by 4 and your house payment is 25% of it, then that's a good healthy margin. I know there's banks that will go all the way up to, I don't know what, 40%, 50%, like depending on who you find to give you the mortgage, they will loan it to you. I'm sure that people live off of different scales, but generally speaking, that's a good principle. The reason for the down payment is that historically, whenever you are borrowing money, if you have a down payment, you instantly have a word called equity. That means that say, you, I know you can't, but say that at one point in history, you could have bought a house for $100,000. You put $20,000 down, you have $20,000 worth of equity. So if you immediately have to move 3 months from now when you weren't planning on it, you're not upside down in the house, you can actually sell the house and you get your equity back. The other thing it does is it mitigates risk, because I know it hasn't happened in a long time, but it's especially in California, there was a period where there was certain valleys out there, the districts, whatever they called them, where there was a giant housing bubble. So everybody wanted to buy a house in the valley. The prices went through the roof. People bought the houses. And then whatever happened with the economy, a year later, all of the houses were actually worth a lot less than what they were a year ago. So if you had put down a 20% payment and then a year later you needed to move, you could just sell the house, take the hit, but not be upside down and be like, well, I can't even sell the house and move on unless I get enough money from somebody else to pay off the mortgage. Now, the reason that he recommends the 15-year term is that you slash the interest you pay back to the bank like crazy if you get out your calculators and run the model, and then say you buy a house whatever age of life you are, after 15 years, if your mortgage is paid off, now you can focus more on your other investments. Now, I already know what everybody is thinking. I've been on Zillow, and that's not possible, and it may not be. It's actually about the only thing I've ever heard him start to adjust his plan is he says, okay, if you have 10% or 5% and you really want to do that, that's fine. But we still think it's better if you have the 20%. Reason being that, I just said all the reasons. So let me not say that all over again. So Lord help me, what was I going to say next to explain that point? Now, what has happened recently in America and in our area specifically is that sort of in a way, sadly, our housing market is starting to look more and more like sections of New York and California, where it's very expensive, very competitive. A few years ago, a house went on the market. They had 30 offers before the weekend was over. Now, houses are actually sitting for 30 days, but the prices are not really coming back down much compared to how high they've actually risen. So you actually could have 5 years ago in this area said, well, I'm not buying a house till I save up this much money and get a shorter term. And you actually would have made more money if you had bought sooner before the market skyrocketed. But those things are very hard to predict. So a sound principle is still a sound principle. But again, you have to decide for your life, are you going to put it on hold until, you know, you can do it perfectly? Or if you think it's a good investment, maybe you do it in a slightly less classical way as far as sound principles. I would just say this, a couple of things, sort of my personal advice. The most important thing, I think, is that your monthly budget's not upside down. Okay, so maybe right now we're not as worried about the market crashing and it takes a long time to get 20% saved up. But if you are locking in your loan and buying a house where the percentage of your take-home pay is very high, it can actually be stressful very quickly. So here's the other thing he says, and the other thing I would say, it's okay to not buy a house. Because you know what we feel is a lot of people, well, you need to buy a house. It's a good investment. And then what we see every time we see the news saying the prices are going up, we start to feel panicky, fear of missing out. And what do we usually do when we are panicking? Make better decisions or worse decisions? We usually make worse decisions. So usually the decision you regret is the one you rush into. If you were taking your time and there was an open door and that opportunity went away, I promise you eventually there will be other wise opportunities for getting ahead. It very rarely works where you miss your one chance in life to get ahead, but it very often works out where you rush into something and later that's when you look back and you wish that you hadn't. Some people say your first year of marriage is a good time to just rent and not worry about buying a house because buying a house can actually be very stressful. What you can do is you can invest in other ways and look to the future and pray about, Lord, what could we do long term? Are we going to live here forever? Is housing cheaper somewhere else? Can we get our careers on a higher trajectory? Or just rent, because it's really okay to rent. The plus of buying a property or buying a house to live in is you lock in your payment. Even when you have a mortgage, you're locking in your monthly rate, whereas rent will continually increase over time based just off of the history of the country. It will slowly continue to go up. And if you buy a house, your mortgage is locked in. And then you got to worry about the taxes that you weren't paying before, and your taxes keep going up and up either way. So that's one of the reasons I think why people like that say it is okay to borrow money for a house is because it's nearly impossible not to. Like I said last week, if you were living in rural Arkansas 10 years ago and working a bunch of jobs, you might have been able to drive 30 minutes from where your jobs were and buy a $65,000 house. And maybe you could have taken 3 years and saved the money and paid cash. But the way it works now, if you were trying to pay cash, especially in this area, you would probably spend your whole life trying to save up the money unless you make a lot of money. If you make a lot of money, if you make $300,000 a year and you live off of $100,000, you still could do it. And that would be a great idea, but you have to pay for housing anyway. So if you can do it in a wise way, a house is an investment that goes up in value. And if you do it in a wise way, you're sort of building equity instead of paying rent for no equity, which you would have to pay anyway. Now, the other thing about buying a house is you have to remember if you don't do it the right way, it can end up not being a blessing. It can end up being very stressful. When you rent and there's a hole in the roof, you call the landlord and say, come fix it. when you own the house and the air conditioner goes out, tell you from the church ones, the good quotes are probably around $8,000 to get the whole system replaced. So if you have no savings, you're very stressed in your budget, and you buy a house and the air conditioner breaks down, you've either got to borrow the money or find a way really quickly to come up with it, because it's on you to pay for all of those things. So sometimes what people are doing around here is they're making a longer commute, and that's okay too. But I've heard some people that were trying to drive 2.5 hours one way to get to work Monday through Friday in Dallas traffic, and you may do that for 6 months and think, I wish I'd never bought a house. I don't need the house that much. So I think the basic idea is it's a good investment if you do it the right way. If your margins are healthy, that's a minimum. If you can do it on a shorter term note, you'll pay it off sooner. You'll save a lot of interest. And if you can put a down payment, then that's great as well. I'm sorry, I'm at the end of my notes. Let me just read what I got, and then I'll see if anybody had a question here before we dismiss. It's okay not to buy a house. Don't stress about that. You can invest in other ways. Try to remember to factor in the cost, the idea of driving a long way, and those different types of things, and be okay with waiting and only doing it if it actually makes sense for you. If you purchase it wisely, it is a good investment, and it historically has been, because you're locking in the rate of housing in your budget that you're going to pay, but only do it if you're ready financially. Okay, I've got other stories that factor in to this buying property thing from a church aspect and some different illustrations I've heard, but I'm going to park it right there. So when we come back next week, I'll give that little part as the introduction, and then we'll move into number 7 and 8. And I think we'll have to conclude this next week, because I'm down to the last page and a half of my notes here. So let me mark where I am right here. And does anyone have a question or feedback or anything? It's okay if not, but it's okay even to throw it out there if it's something you kind of have a different perspective or different idea on. It's or question or didn't understand. It's totally up to you all. Would anybody like to ask a question or say anything before we're dismissed here tonight? Yes.
My husband and I actually took the Dave Ramsey University thing for, like, I think it's like 9 weeks. And we actually were able to get out of, I would say, roughly $37,000 debt in like 6-7 months.
That is amazing, and I want to say thank you for sharing that, because that's part of what the whole idea of doing this together instead of reading something at home is somebody can share that. So it's called Financial Peace University. It's about a 9-week class. It might cost you $100, $130. I know that I think you can do it online now, but there also has historically been like local churches or schools where you can take it with other people so you can give feedback. When I get to the end of this series, whenever that is, I'm going to put together a sheet that is recommended financial resources. I'll put that one on there. So if you don't happen to be here that night and then you wanted to see what it was, just let me know and I'll share it with you. But that's a great story that by taking the class and by doing that particular plan, which I'm sure is not the only plan, but is a good one, in 6 months, they were able to pay off that debt, which I'm sure is a really good feeling as well. So anybody else? I agree with that, and I think we'll talk more about that in detail when we ever get to the savings investing part. I think the basics, again, I know I keep saying his name 100 times, but what Dave Ramsey says is have your 3 to 6 months emergency fund, then everything else you're basically spending, giving, or investing. And in general, yes, if you have $300,000 someone gave you, you put it in your savings account for 10 years and slowly spend it. It doesn't keep up with inflation, but if you have it in a sound investment where it grows, 10 years later, it might have actually doubled to be worth $600,000. And eventually down the line, if it gets big enough, you can virtually live in retirement off of the dividends it produces. But yes, that's a good point, sir. Anybody else? All right. Well, even after class, anybody wants to keep kicking stuff around, just let me know, because I know sometimes it's like that too. Well, I did have a question, but I didn't want to say it in front of the whole church, so that's fine. Let me see. David, would you mind dismissing us with a word of prayer tonight? Thank you, sir.